content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled, A Striking New Tactic by Luke Savage. When automotive workers in Flint sat down at their jobs and stood up for workers' rights. As the clock struck noon on January 11, 1937, roughly 800 men camped on the second floor of a Flint auto plant suddenly found themselves without heat. Under normal circumstances, there might have been 1,000 workers inside the Fisher No. 2 facility, bustling to produce auto bodies, sending 450 of them to a Chevrolet assembly facility across the road every 24 hours. But the day's more austere climate owed itself to decidedly unusual circumstances. On December 30th, the men inside the plant had joined fellow workers in a daring strike action with the aim of forcing a reluctant General Motors to recognize their union, the United Auto Workers, UAW. Eschewing the traditional method of picketing outside, their primary chosen tactic, the sit-down strike was as disruptive as it was rare. As Greg Zipes, an attorney who teaches at New York University's School of Professional Studies, has written, workers stay at their workstations to prevent any other workers, presumably non-union strike bearers, from taking their place. Because the processes involved in automobile production were so tightly integrated, relatively small numbers of workers placed at strategically chosen choke points could effectively paralyze production, even at an industrial leviathan like GM. Since the sit-down had begun, the thousands of strikers had passed the time in relative peace, undisturbed by GM management and the police. But, feeling a sudden burst of winter air at midday, the workers realized something was afoot. Sure enough, the company had switched off the heat, and company guards were outside, also blocking the delivery of food, marking the first in a series of escalations that culminated in a violent clash that night. When police arrived to relieve the beleaguered guards, they began hurling tear gas and eventually fired bullets and buckshot at the strikers. The workers replied in kind with water from fire hoses and ad hoc projectiles. It was like a war of revolution, a union photographer who witnessed the melee recalled, with broken glass and lumps of coal and hinges from Chevrolets. At least 9 police and 14 strikers were injured. Most of the latter suffered bullet wounds. Receiving news of the battle a little over 50 miles away at his office in Lansing, Michigan, Michigan's newly inaugurated governor, Frank Murphy, promptly decided to intervene. Accompanied by the state's police commissioner and the adjutant general of its National Guard, he set out to visit Flint. In any other state, Murphy's arrival might have easily been the prelude to an even more dangerous confrontation. But in Flint, once word reached the auto workers that Murphy was en route and planned to send in troops, the atmosphere was one of jubilation. The governor was interceding on their behalf. With the clash still raging, 25-year-old organizer Victor Reuther, then outside the buildings in a car with an exterior sound system, seized on the news to taunt the police. You'd better go home before Governor Murphy gets after you. Reuther's optimism was soon to be vindicated. On Murphy's orders, a throng of armed guardsmen arrived the next morning and took up positions outside the occupied factories to create a buffer between the strikers and local authorities. Officially, according to the governor's neutrally worded public statements, the troops' role was simply to preserve order and prevent further violence. Unofficially, their deployment represented an unprecedented political intervention on the side of organized labor and ultimately enabled the auto workers to defeat one of the world's largest corporations and score a monumental union victory that would help define American labor relations for decades to come. When workers at the two Flint GM plants had abruptly gone idle at their machines and refused to move in December 1936, they ignited an industrial dispute in the automotive heartlands of Michigan that quickly spread to plants in Toledo, Ohio, and Janesville, Wisconsin. Lasting 44 days and involving some 136,000 workers, the strike had been decades in the making. Well before the mid-1930s, Flint was an important center of industrialization. As a leading producer of carriages in the late 19th century, it was already an established hub of transport manufacturing by the time GM was founded in 1908, earning the moniker Vehicle City. The ensuing decade saw a boom for American cars as new factories sprang up and vehicles streamed off the assembly lines in ever greater numbers. And sales accordingly increased nearly 25-fold between 1910 and 1929. Flint's population exploded too, rising to 156,492 by 1930, roughly 12 times its population when the century began. GM, in turn, soon grew into a globe-spanning industrial colossus, and by the mid-1930s, it had more than 60 plants across 14 states. The cars and trucks produced by its 171,711 hourly workers, accounting for an astonishing 37% of all global sales. Like most of their fellow industrial workers in the 1930s, though, the company's laborers received no sick benefits, pension plans, or paid time off, and they lacked basic job security. In stark contrast to many of GM's white-collar and managerial staff, whose employment often came with insurance and sick pay. Industrial work could be incredibly dangerous, and safety precautions were virtually non-existent. One Buick metalworking shop was so prone to injuries that it was nicknamed the Slaughterhouse. Things worsened with the Depression, which created an unemployment pool so vast that GM could and did treat its workers as more or less disposable and fire them at will. Wages were paid out only if the line stayed running, and the company sometimes punished workers with cuts to their hourly pay for failing to meet quotas. Working conditions were atrocious, one former employee reflected to a BBC documentary crew several decades after the strike. The line was so fast you didn't have time to go to the restroom. When he got home after work, I would clean up and go to bed. I couldn't even eat. I was that tired. Yet against this bleak backdrop, the political ferment of the new emerging New Deal era saw both a growing climate of worker militancy and a newfound pro-labor bent among some of the country's leading Democratic politicians. Signed into law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act established a legal framework for unions. Though amid legal challenges by big employers, legislation rested on shaky ground, and actually organizing a union, especially in the automotive sector, remained incredibly difficult. GM was determined to crush even the thought of any collective action, and throughout the mid-1930s, it surveyed its employees so aggressively that a subsequent congressional inquiry dubbed its contract with the Pinkerton Detective Agency a monument to the most colossal super system of spies yet devised in any American corporation. Despite the company's best efforts to cover up such espionage, GM official Merrill Howell conceded as much, saying in his testimony before a 1937 Senate committee that he had retained the Pinkerton Agency because he wanted to know the source of labor dissatisfaction, as well as monitor meetings with labor organizers and track criticisms of management. Working with another labor group, the Committee for Industrial Organizations, CIO, the fledgling UAW launched an organizing drive in the summer of 1936, but found only modest success. Its efforts, however, were soon buoyed by Roosevelt's landslide reelection in the November presidential contest. And closer to home, by the concurrent election of Democrat Murphy as Michigan's governor. A lawyer of Irish descent and a devout Catholic with an innate sense of justice, Murphy had campaigned aggressively for labor support and arguably owed his narrow victory to workers' votes. While other Democratic governors, like Ohio's Martin L. Davey, had no qualms about deploying troops against striking workers, Murphy proved remarkably resistant to repeated calls for the use of force, even as the UAW made use of the radical and disruptive sit-down tactic. From GM's point of view, the sit-downers were illegally trespassing, plain and simple. In this spirit, the company duly secured an injunction from State Circuit Judge Edward D. Black for their removal, but Murphy refused to enforce it. When GM escalated by cutting off the heat at Fisher No. 2 on January 11th, the governor responded by making his most consequential and fateful intervention in the strike. Murphy demanded that the company restore heat in the plants and ordered Michigan's Welfare Department to provide direct food aid to the striking workers. And while Murphy played the role of neutral mediator in public, he effectively sided with the union by deploying the National Guard as a buffer, privately telling UAW organizer Robert Travis and CIO leader John L. Lewis that the troops would protect the strikers inside and outside the plants and prevent their ejection. Even by the pro-labor standards of the New Deal era, Murphy's conduct during the strike made him an outlier among Democratic governors. With sit-downs protected, the union was soon able to go on the offensive with a daring feint. On February 1st, workers at Flint's relatively insignificant Chevrolet No. 9 facility launched a mock sit-down action that lured GM guards to converge on the scene, enabling other workers to blockade themselves inside the more strategically valuable Chevrolet No. 4, which made engines for Chevrolets. "We have the key plan of the GM, and the eyes of the world are looking at us," one worker who participated in the action wrote in a letter to his wife. "We sure done a thing that GM said never could be done." Served with a new court injunction ordering them to leave the occupied plants, the workers held their ground, and on the morning of February 3rd, their ranks swelled as fellow UAW members and other supporters came in from Detroit and Toledo in a mass gesture of solidarity. By the afternoon, some 3,000 picketers had assembled outside Fisher No. 1, as other strikers occupied Flint's main arterial road and paraded through its downtown. Amid this show of strength, GM soon had no choice but to yield. On February 11th, having produced a mere 151 cars in the United States since February 1st, the company capitulated and officially pledged to recognize the UAW in a signing ceremony presided over by Murphy himself. Victorious workers streamed out of their factories and formed a triumphant procession. They marched and they sang and they danced all night long in the streets of the city of Flint, organizer Janora Johnson Dollinger recalled in a 1976 documentary. Buick workers and AC workers from a nearby GM spark plug plant, "These plants weren't even on strike, came down and they celebrated with us." Murphy, though, was defeated in his bid for re-election as governor in 1938. In part because of the backlash from pro-business forces following his intercession in the strike. He would go on to serve as U.S. Attorney General and sit on the Supreme Court. Ultimately, says Harry R. Rubenstein, curator emeritus in the Division of Political History at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, the strike should be remembered as a story of how individual workers, unorganized, decided to take a militant kind of tactic to change the balance of power between labor and business. And it wouldn't have happened without the New Deal. It was the biggest, most important corporation in the world being challenged, and successfully challenged by labor. This is Nelson Lichtenstein, a labor historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It was, unquestionably, the most consequential strike of the 20th century. Once they win in Flint and they have a signed contract, hundreds of thousands of workers pour into the UAW, and other managers, other capitalists say, "Okay, if the most important company in the world is signing with the union, well, maybe we better do it too." Thinking back nearly 40 years later, one retired worker explained, "Today I'm sitting here with over $600 a month in pension. It all came through organized labor. At my old age, I'm able to sit around and do what I want to do. They got 40 years of me down there, the best of my life, and now I'm able to enjoy a little bit of it. And if we hadn't struck, we wouldn't have had nothing. We had to do it. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Americana Dream by Andrew Zaleski. Among restorers of classic collectibles, Curtis Kaufman reigns supreme. Curtis Kaufman was always crazy about Coca-Cola merch. In 1990, just after he and his wife Gina purchased their first home in Hagerstown, Maryland, he began converting his basement into a soda fountain straight out of the 1950s. A counter composed of white Subway tile, white-legged stools with red seats, old-timey signs listed the price of an ice-cold Coke, a bargain at 5 cents. He even stood up a life-size cutout of James Dean sporting a Coke-branded apron. Kaufman's amateur setup was more than just a cool room he could show off to friends and family. It was the start of his serious obsession with collecting nostalgic objects. I had heard about Kaufman and his fixation on the past from my father-in-law, who lives in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, population 4,200. Barely 20 minutes by car over the border from Kaufman's house in Maryland. Kaufman was something of a small-town celebrity. He'd gotten famous doing restoration work for big stars, guys like country artist Alan Jackson, retired Yankees right fielder Reggie Jackson, and original Foreigner frontman Lou Gramm. I caught up with him one August afternoon in a small storefront that served as his base of operations for Memory Lane, the restoration business Kaufman has run for 28 years. A sign on the door lets visitors know his shop of curios is open by appointment only. When I got there, his 2002 Ferrari 360 Modena was parked outside. I was admiring it just as Kaufman opened the door to let me in. He's a slim, short man of 63 years, though he hardly looks it, with gray, close-cropped hair, a salt-and-pepper goatee, and a talkative streak. When I entered the shop, I felt like Michael J. Fox stepping out of a DeLorean into 1955. In Kaufman's jam-packed showroom, there were Lurlitzer jukeboxes, classic candy machines, and pinball games, plus a variety of chrome-covered kitchen appliances scattered about. On a series of backlit shelves was an assortment of other objects, working gumball machines, desktop cutters for snipping the ends off cigars, and vintage Vornado brand fans, which, Kaufman tells me, were used by bank tellers in the middle of last century to keep cool in the summer. Neon signs adorn the walls, logos for Sunoco and Chevrolet awash in blue and yellow light, as well as an original Woolworth's storefront banner. Kaufman had restored them all. He led me to his workshop in the next room, revealing three workstations, each equipped with wrenches, pliers, screwdrivers, nails, screws, tape, wires. Everything he needs to restore old items to their glory days. On a shelf up high, I saw a vintage Pepsi Cola sign made of sheet metal, as well as maybe a dozen of fat, empty cans emblazoned with Sunoco motor oil on the front. He quickly turned my attention to the disassembled pieces of an original Speed Cop toy bike that dates to the 1920s. The red frame of the bike was laid out, its big front wheel already attached. On a paper towel next to it sat the washers, nuts, and bolts required to finish its assembly. Once it was back together, Kaufman told me, it would be fully functional, and the wheels would roll like they were brand new. Everything we do works, Kaufman said. If you're buying from us, you can actually use it. Some of his restoration jobs are custom projects requested by collectors who ship him items from around the country. Others are forgotten treasures he ferrets out at antique malls and flea markets and then brings back to life. Most buyers are guys. They may want unique artifacts to place in their man caves, or they may be men who have made their fortunes and developed an itch for Art Deco and mid-century memorabilia, stuff like vintage golf ball washing stations or old FM radios. In a normal year, Kaufman absolutely cleans up on sales, and that's because in the small world of soup-to-nuts restoration of Americana, he's widely regarded as the finest craftsman. He does the best restoration work of anybody, says Bruce Wiener, a longtime Kaufman customer who previously owned the Double Bubble Gum Company for 23 years. He literally takes the machine right down to the last nut, bolt, screw, washer, and replaces and repaints and redoes everything. Today, Kaufman's business is continuing to grow. He recently sold the original storefront I visited and moved the business into a Route 11 antique mall, a brand new 27,000 square foot property that he opened in Hagerstown. In the back is the restoration shop, where Kaufman continues to work his magic. Yet as soon as I learned, Kaufman's creative talent is not only a way to turn back time on forgotten objects, it's also his way of rewriting a difficult childhood. Toys hold a special significance for Kaufman. His 18-year-old father was killed by a drunk driver when he was just 2 months old. His mother was always in and out of work, he said, and could barely afford rent for a long period of time. I went to 13 different schools because we were always moving, Kaufman told me. Every time he and his mother had to move, Kaufman was forced to abandon whatever toys he'd managed to scrounge. Hot Wheels cars were a particular favorite, as well as a Bowl-O-Matic 300 tabletop bowling game, complete with miniature pins and balls. His mother always promised replacements, but was often too poor to afford even basic necessities. As an adult, Kaufman resolved to live a different life. Married since the late 1980s, he and Gina have one grown son, Logan, whom Kaufman employs at Memory Lane. I just had the determination, he said, that if I ever had a family, my family wouldn't live the same way I lived. Kaufman opened a glass tinting business in 1989, and once the firm was profitable, turned to his true love, collecting. He started with Hot Wheels cars, which he stockpiled in the thousands, and Coca-Cola memorabilia. Then he began searching for the toys he'd lost during his peripatetic childhood. First up were vintage Schwinn bikes. Then he got his hands on a yellow Honda QA50 mini bike. As Kaufman accumulated more old stuff, he lamented that many of the pieces he was collecting were in regrettable disrepair, and he couldn't find anyone he trusted to refurbish them. So I would tear it apart and redo it to make the quality to what I was pleased with, he said. Then friends and other people would say, hey, could you do this for me? By the late 1990s, Kaufman had found a way to make money from his all-consuming hobby and was spending most of his free time restoring toys and other items from the past. Vintage soda machines and retro stoner candy machines were some of his favorites. Kaufman wanted to devote himself to this work full-time. So in 1995, he sold his glass tinting business and opened his first antique mall in Hagerstown, Maryland. By his account, the tinting business was a success, which explains how he could afford a Ferrari. Soon he began restoring items for customers he met at car shows. Kaufman hit pay dirt when he attended his first Mecum auto auction at the Indiana State Fairgrounds about 18 years ago and made $125,000 in just 3 days. As it turns out, many of the same guys who own sports cars are also deeply interested in buying refurbished items from a bygone era. Eventually, Kaufman couldn't manage both the antique mall and a growing restoration business, so he sold the first mall and launched Memory Lane in 1997. For years, my wife would always tell me, "You need to get a real job," Kaufman said. But pretty soon, he was making more from restorations than he'd ever made from tinting. It got to the point where if I would have gotten a real job, we'd have been poor. Ask him how he even learned to do any of this stuff, and you get an old school answer you might expect. Take a lot of pictures and just figure it out. Kaufman also credits his longtime employee, Stephen Pryor, who's been with him since 1998, as a stalwart collaborator. When we were down and out, didn't know what the next buck was coming from, he was there. Kaufman and Pryor restore heirloom goods by refinishing items from the inside out. They disassemble every object down to its nuts and bolts, then separate and label each piece. In the early days, Kaufman was doing all the refurbishing work in-house. As his customer base expanded, he needed help and started outsourcing different tasks to local contractors. For instance, he gets assistant sandblasting parts, which removes any rust and sometimes has outside contractors powder coat bare metal, which gives it a hard finish that is difficult to damage. Then comes a custom paint job, often by local painters. Still, the actual assembly and creative vision come from Kaufman, and this is where he distinguishes himself from competitors. Most people in the restoration business, he told me, specialize in what he calls 5-foot restorations. From 5 feet away, they look great. But up close, he said, his voice trailing off. Indeed, Kaufman is fastidious, with an obsessive, close eye for detail. As if to drive home his point, Kaufman showed me a Mazda-branded lamp he recently finished. Not only were all the visible screw heads polished to a bright sheen, but each one of the flathead screws was also turned to the same position. Very occasionally, rather than doing a simple restoration, Kaufman will reinvent an object. He's turned old gas pumps into refrigerators, preserving the charming look of an old petrol service station, but now with the ability to chill beverages. He's got a guy who repairs the old compressors for him. During my visit, Kaufman showed me an old telephone booth, pristine and freshly painted in Ferrari red. With vintage phones, he gets inventive. The payphone remains intact, as if you could make a collect call on it. Next thing you know, Kaufman is pulling open the payphone's coin box, which he set on hinges to reveal a custom box filled with key hooks, the perfect collectible for his clients who have more than a dozen cars. Everybody says I'm the Picasso of doing all this creative stuff, said Kaufman, though he quibbles somewhat with this adulation. In person, he comes across as modest, yet much of the restored stuff Kaufman displays at Memory Lane is expensive. Many items sell for thousands of dollars. He keeps business coming in by going to 3 car shows every year, 2 in Pennsylvania and 1 in Florida. He packs a 22-foot-long trailer filled with items he has refurbished, sets up a booth, and can pull in anywhere between $40,000 and $140,000 in sales at a single show. The people he meets typically become regular clients, and that's when they start sending Kaufman their own antiques to refurbish. Some of his customers are looking to turn a profit or build wealth through their collecting. Wiener, for instance, sold all the old wooden candy machines that Kaufman restored for him, as well as a cache of Polaroid cameras he'd stockpiled, which Kaufman spiffed up. But most collectors are in it for the feelings an object resurrects. People start collecting because they are emotionally engaged, says Lila Dunbar, professional appraiser who worked on PBS's Antiques Roadshow. People love something that's old and new again, all at the same time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Keppen family. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.